Welcome back to Aggie Radio, KVLU LP 92.3. This is the Aggie Morning Word, and I'm Morgan Pratt.
I'm Brad Robinson.
And we're very excited because Robert Gillies is here. Robert, how are you?
I'm fine, and a very good morning to you.
Thank you. You too. Robert, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, it's a long history. I'm originally from Scotland, as you can tell from my accent. I've been at Utah State now for about 18 years. I came from the Penn State, okay, where I did a lot of my meteorology. And I'm a professor here in climate. I'm in the Plant, Soils, and Climate Department. And let's see, I'm the director of the Utah Climate Center, and I'm also the state climatologist.
Excellent. So what is it? What is the Utah Climate Center, for those who don't know?
So the Utah Climate Center is funded through the state to provide climate services and research for the state of Utah. So what I mean by services is we provide data, sort of climate data, in all sort of aspects. And then a lot of people have difficulty interpreting that data, and so maybe they want advice on that. So we interpret the data for them, and we do that in all sorts of venues, from the general public to the courtroom.
Oh, really? In the courtroom?
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, if you think about it, weather affects us all,
okay? Sure.
And climate affects us all. And it can affect us in good ways and bad ways. If it's too hot, you can overheat. If it's too cold, you can get frostbite, etc., etc. But where we come in, usually, as far as the court is concerned, is when, say, there's damage done to a house and the insurance company won't pay up. And so they end up with a court case. And so we go there. Usually they ask for the records, and we send the records for, you know, the wind gusts and things like that for the various stations around the site. And then we go in and testify that they are indeed true and representative. Things like that.
Wow.
So that's one example. There's been other examples of floods.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Where a basement has flooded and they blamed a local, I would say petrol station, but you would say gas station, right?
Okay, yeah.
where they blamed the construction of a new gas station that it produced a lot of what's called impervious surface. So there was much greater water runoff as a result of that.
Sure.
But it turned out really the problem was it was a convective storm that was very intense, and it wasn't really the impervious surface. So those are a couple of examples for you.
Well, I didn't even know. I didn't even know you were involved in court cases. That's awesome.
Yeah, that's really interesting to find out that maybe there's more to the Climate Center than just talking about what climate change is or what's going on with that.
Right. Yeah, the climate change is an interesting one, because when I first came on as director, I didn't expect that I would be really involved in that. And of course, you know, that ends. I mean, I was kind of naive.
Sure.
I thought, oh, we're just going to provide services. But then within, I think, a week of me taking the position, Judy Fays from the Salt Lake Tribune called me up.
Yeah.
And suddenly, right, life became real again.
How long ago was that?
That was about 8-9 years
ago. Sure,
So
we've been experiencing really weird weather the last, I don't know, 3-4 weeks.
Yeah.
A lot of snow, really cold, lots of avalanches, flooding, like you mentioned. What's up with that?
Well, our research suggests that in terms of global warming, which is the overall warming of the planet, doesn't necessarily mean that regionally or locally it will warm, okay? Because climate is a global thing, and it's driven by many, many factors. For example, Utah's climate is often driven by what happens in the Western Pacific, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, we've been getting rather interesting weather. It's very difficult to attribute one event to, say, global warming, but when you look at the pattern as a whole, Utah's climate and weather is shifting, in terms of precipitation that is, it's shifting from snow to rain, okay? You would never expect, say, 20 years ago to have any rain in northern Utah at this time of year, okay? And you've seen this interesting pattern of lots and lots of snow, then lots of rain, followed by lots of snow. And that's kind of interesting because what the research that we've done has shown that that is indeed happening, that we're shifting from snow to rain, okay? But we're actually getting more precipitation, but more of it is coming as extreme events with less storms. So the storms that do come in are more intense.
Sure, yeah.
Now, what is interesting about this particular period that we've just experienced is that we've had a cold outbreak, you know, from the Arctic, followed by very warm tropical air. And that tropical air is often called the Pineapple Express, or it can be called an atmospheric river, because basically the reason it's called the Pineapple Express is because you're getting very, very warm, moist air coming up from Hawaii.
Okay.
Oh. And what's Hawaii famous for? Sugar and pineapples.
There you go. Yeah.
Not so much anymore, but in the past, you know, they were major producers of those products.
So one of the questions that I'm kind of interested in is how researchers can look at kind of weather events and as a whole and say, is this, does this have something to do with climate change? How can you, how do people understand what's happening with the climate?
So it's a tough question to answer, and attribution is always a difficult thing to show in many respects and in many disciplines. But we meteorologists slash climate scientists are have very, very rich global data sets, okay? And we have certain data sets called reanalyses, which are very useful. And I won't go into what a reanalysis is.
That's perfectly fine.
It's a very they are very useful data sets. And we have sort of various techniques, mostly statistical techniques, fairly, you know, complex statistical methods that we apply on that data to trace things back. And we call that climate diagnostics. Okay, so we can look at a particular event and then we can trace back, you know, where that sort of event sort of is its origin, you know. So, for example, there might be a very, very cold outbreak in Europe, and that cold outbreak, you know, is under sort of high pressure usually. But if you have this cold outbreak, it can generate waves in the atmosphere, and those waves then traverse over to the US, okay, and then affect us. So anything, any sort of event that happens anywhere in the world, that energy can actually be transmitted to other places and affect their, you know, weather. So say, for example, you know, you get a big change in warming in one area of the planet, then it is actually going to affect other areas as a result of that. If that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it does.
it makes sense to me. I really enjoy reading about climate change, and so maybe that...
Well, one of the really interesting aspects is if you actually go onto NASA's website and look at the global temperatures, right, you will notice that certain areas of the planet are warming up more than others.
Yeah.
And one that stands out as a big bullet, okay, a big target, is the Arctic, okay, and Alaska, so the Northern Hemisphere. And it has warmed up way, way more than, say, the equator. Now, what drives climate is the temperature differential between the northern part of the planet and the equator. And if that temperature differential changes, which it has an effect on what's called our jet stream. And the jet stream, okay, changes as a result of that temperature differential. And that's why you're getting these sort of cold outbreaks and things like that. It was part of the equation, put it that way.
So is this crazy winter, is that something we should expect for the next rest of our lives?
No, because the really irritating thing about studying climate in the Western states, right, in the West, is that we have a high degree of variability, right, whereas the East doesn't. Okay, so we have a high degree of variability, so it can vary a lot from one year to the next.
Why is that?
Because of the different dynamics that are in play through the Western Pacific and the Pacific Ocean compared to the East. They have different dynamics, okay?
Sure.
So that's one of the factors. It's multifactorial. So what is what I can tell you, and this is where, you know, I sort of put my head on the chopping block, right, is that in the north, in northern Utah, we're driven by what happens in the western Pacific as far as precipitation is concerned.
Sure.
And that has a cycle. It's one of what's known as a climate cycle. Yeah. And there are many climate cycles. I think the most famous one that people will talk about or know about is the El Nino, right?
Sure.
La Nina, or we call it the Enso cycle, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, there's another one, which is called the quasi-decadal, which quasi means roughly, or, you know, decadal.
Not quite as catchy.
Right. Not quite as catchy, isn't it? Yeah, yeah, that's very true. But it's a quasi-decadal. It's roughly 10 to 12 years, okay? So what it does is it drives 6 years of drought and 6 years of wet, okay? Now, our research discovered this. It was Dr. Wang, who was my postdoc at the time, who did all the research on this. And the interesting thing about this cycle with its 6 months dry is we've just come out, according to our research, we've just come out of the 6 months of dry, and we're moving out into the, did I say 6 months?
Six years.
Okay. You have to make sure and correct me, right? So we've got, we should have 6 years of wet. But remember, we have a high degree of variability.
Sure.
So that doesn't necessarily mean that it will be consistently very dry through the next 6 years. So each year will be slightly different in terms of quote-unquote wetness.
Sure.
Right? So we should be in for 6 years of, shall we say, above average precipitation.
Is that good news for our California neighbors?
Yes.
Yeah.
They don't think it's good news at the moment, not if your house is being flooded, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But the reservoirs are being filled rather nicely. Mm-hmm. And so they've gone from what, 5% of the, what is it, 5% to 25%. They've had a great deal of relief.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah.
A great deal of relief. I don't like quoting numbers because oftentimes they're not really all that meaningful.
Sure. Right? Sure.
Yeah. Speaking of, I guess, kind of numbers, there's been a little bit of news relating to political events where I've heard that climate scientists have been collecting a lot of the data from the United States. Could you talk about what kind of data we have in the United States and why it seems so valuable to Canadians and the rest of the scientific community?
Huh.
Well, I'm not sure how true and how great an extent this collection of data is going on. And actually, I did an interview with Emma Penrod at the Salt Lake Tribune on this.
Uh-huh.
Is it Penrod? I think it is.
I think so.
I mean, scientists, there's a lot of data, let me tell you, okay? And it goes from observations all over the planet, from the oceans to the land to the cryosphere. There's a lot of satellite data, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you want to be able to show trends or if things are changing, you need a continuous record, right? So as I said to Emma, I'm more concerned about this record being maintained, right? Because if, say, NASA or NOAA get cut back big time, then their ability to maintain that data repository becomes marginalized, okay? And at the time I was, mentioning to Emma, you know, that people call up the Climate Center from all walks of life, from the government, from industry, from legal perspectives, and they need this data, right? So it's very important that we maintain that continuity of data. So the kind of data, I mean, honestly, we could have a whole show on the data, right?
Yeah.
So there are in-situ observations where we go out and take measurements of temperature and things like that. There are automated stations that do that. We profile the atmosphere, for example. That means that we have a little recording box called a radio sonde, and it's tied to a balloon, and it's released twice a day at airports all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that profiles the atmosphere for temperature, moisture, winds, etc. That data goes into the meteorological models. We call it initialization. So we initialize the models with that data and surface data. And from that, then the models produce a forecast, right? And there are meteorological models which say go out, 5 or 6 days. Then you've got the climate models, which go out months. And then you've got the big GCMs, which are way, way different in terms of time scale. So there's all sorts of data, you know, like that. You know, we also take data, you know, profiling the oceans, how temperature is changing there. Satellite data, as I mentioned before. So huge data resources.
So it sounds like that data is used for a lot more than just, well, not just, but a lot more than research into global warming or climate change.
Right. It's used to understand the phenomena that comprise climate, for one thing. So there's a research aspect of it, but then there's also commercial aspect. If you're an oil company, for example, and you have big rigs out in the, you know, in the ocean, okay, and there's a hurricane or a tropical cyclone coming towards you, okay, the models are used to compute the trajectory of that storm system, okay, and so it allows the oil companies to anticipate whether they need to evacuate their personnel and shore down should that, you know, system be coming through them. And if you think about it, time is money, right?
Sure, yeah.
So the more time, more information they have to say, oh yeah, the likelihood of it hitting you is, you know, 50% or something like that, they can make judgment calls based upon that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I think that we're running out of time right now, but is there anything else you want to add? Anything else you're thinking about right now?
Oh, I'm just thinking about, you know, the fact that this will be the first year that we start our undergraduate major in climate science.
Oh, that's awesome.
So any people who are really interested in becoming climate scientists, and there's going to be lots of opportunities for jobs in the future, they might want to stop by and talk to us.
Well, that's excellent. Well, thank you so much for having Rob. This is Robert Gillies and Gillies.
That's right, Gillis.
Gillis. He's here. He's with the Utah Climate Center. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Morgan.
So that wraps up the Aggie Morning Word. You guys have an excellent weekend. We'll be back Monday with some more interviews. Thank you so much for listening.